Major Han, Reel 12.
You were saying that you were running across the desert and the ration truck suddenly appeared.
Yes, this lorry came to our right. As we were running, there was Taffy Roberts on my right, Jack Main on my left, and we were just actually going back out. The shells were dropping, and just from over on our right, you could see this truck loaded with petrol coming through, and five shells dropped right across the front of him. And I thought, oh God, this is it. And he just drove straight through. I mean, for sheer coolness and bravery, I've never seen anything like it. For a man of Wilkes type, you know, if there'd been some others, I'd have thought, well, that's him. But yeah, to do that, I thought, it's really brave. Mm. And he came straight through, and I said, right, open out. I said, Taffy, you jump on the right running board, you jump on the left running board, I'll jump up on the back. And this truck came through, and Jock jumped on the left running board, Taffy on the right. I was still moving in the track.
What sort of speed was it doing, do you think?
I think it must have been doing 15, 20 mile an hour, and faster than it could go, because it was loaded.
Yeah.
And it was a shelf. And I went to get up on the back and couldn't.
You missed it, did you?
I missed it. Mm. And of course, I was running behind.
Yeah.
You know, and the truck was disappearing. And Taffy Roberts could, I was standing on the running board of the shed, and of course there was half doors running, and you could hold on to the door.
Right.
And he could look back to see what was happening, is it? And he could see me coming up in the distance. So he told Charlie Wilkes to slow down until I could run, catch up, jump on the side, and get out of it. So, and we were well out of it, and apparently Matt realised what had happened and came back, but we could signal him from the truck that we were.
You're all right. Mm.
And Sergeant Purvis, who was in the troop over the far side of me, he came over to the car to, thinking that I must have been it to try to rescue us. No, but Wilkes had done it for us, which was brilliant, really.
And what happened to Sergeant Purvis? Was he all right?
Yes, yes, he
managed to get away with it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, where had the car been hit? Did you know?
Well, we don't know. I think it was underneath.
Yes.
You know,
a ricochet.
No, I didn't see if a shell burst underneath, it could do a lot of damage. Stop. You know, probably it might hit. Anywhere.
Yes.
And stop the car from moving. Mm. I mean, it didn't catch fire or anything like that. Mm. It just hit. Mm. And he couldn't get anything out of it. Mm. So, I mean, there's no point in staying. I mean, if we hadn't had a... If it had been something with a big gun on, then we could have turned it and probably used it. But, I mean, there's no point in stopping. So, so we got out, and when we got back to the Liga that night, I retrieved my armoured car. Corporal Prime went back to base, which he never returned, and we carried on the patrols the next day using my armour car.
Where did Corporal Prime come from originally?
Somewhere up in the north.
Had he been in the regiment for long?
Yes, he was a much older man than most of them. Mm. I mean, he'd been... only he'd been made a corporal fairly recently. He wasn't, I wouldn't say, a really an armoured car commander as such. I think, I'm not sure whether he was a reservist. Mm-hmm. I think he was a reservist.
Been recalled.
And I don't think he had the heart for it.
What had he been, do you know what he'd been before he was a corporal?
No.
Would he have been a driver or a gunner?
I don't know what he'd been, actually. Mm. We suddenly got him for some reason or other. I don't know how we managed to get him, quite honestly.
Mm. But you didn't want to keep him?
No, he went back as soon as we you could sort of weed out the people you wanted and the people you didn't want in the troop. And the same, you know, when some of the officers came up, you know, they didn't seem to fit. And so they soon went off somewhere else. I think that's probably in the regiment we had back the each squadron had at least two sergeants commanding troops, which was good, and they were some of the best troop sergeants in the year. I mean, C squadron had Sergeant Sparks, Bob McGuire was C squadron, Robinson. There was quite a lot of really good troop sergeants in the regiment, or troop leaders who were sergeants. So anyway, so the next thing that went on from there, having got back at the Liga, we were in the Liga, and open Liga, and Matt Abraham's car was about 400 yards away from me. And I walked over to him, and as I was talking to him, a formation of bombers, Stukas, came over, 18 Stukas, with four fighters with them. And they came over us, and I said to Matt, I said, somebody's going to get a hammer. And I thought they were going on for a formation, division of headquarters or something like that, you see. And I said, oh, anyway, I'll get back to my army car, just can't stand about it. So I walked back, just got back to the army car, and that was the sun, came these stupors.
So you were the target?
Yeah. Came diving down. And it was the most frightening period in my life, I think. Because you couldn't get your guns up to elevate to shoot at them because of the angle. And they would only elevate so far, so you couldn't do anything. And they came down one by one. And, broken guys, and hear that terrible explosions. And the scream of the dive bomber, which is frightening in itself. And they came down. And RHQ was over the other side of the hill to us in a sort of a body type place. And I say we were the target. And for about 20 minutes, they came down, just dropping their bombs and screaming. And when they'd gone, the fighters came in. It's a machine gun. Well, we could deal with that because
we could shoot back.
But when they'd all gone off, to hear these sort of go away in the distance, the boom, boom, and it's gradually got a tremendous sense of relief. When you hear them coming, what's this? When they're leaving, it's lovely to hear. And when I got out of my armor car, the rear wheel was actually in a bomb hole.
So you've got a very near miss.
Yeah. And all the bins were shattered. Tires, all our rations, the water, and everything had gone. As I say, all around us were bomb marks. And as this one, as I say, it was right on, the wheel was all fucking in. Now, the good thing, where we were, was soft sand. So it absorbed a tremendous amount. The bomb would go in and sort of absorb a lot of it.
So were the bombs burying themselves while they went off?
Yeah, so I think that's what happened, because the hole was quite deep. And it was the soft sand sort of pushing it a lot, I think.
Had this attack done a lot of damage to the squadron?
Well, there was, I think, three definitely killed. There was two badly wounded, two two or three badly wounded. You know, they'd done a lot of damage to us.
Had these men been out of their cars when the attack came in?
The three that were killed by the blast.
Yes. And they were just caught in the open.
They were caught in the open, mm. and the blast had nowhere to go. They laid, knocked down. They were in the fittest side of the soft part of the squadron. Harry Brown, he was badly wounded, and I think there was about seven or eight at least who were either killed or wounded.
Did you lose any vehicles as a result of this attack?
Well, not completely destroyed. I mean,
sounds like there's been a fair amount of damage to all.
But they're all repairable. You could all get new wheels, tyres, and all that sort of thing, which was possible. So, apart from that, we survived. But I'd say it was most frightening. And after that particular episode, my gunner, Webb, every time he heard a plane, he used to get out of the car and run. He'd run right out in the desert. Which was sad, really. I mean, there's nothing you could do about it, and I couldn't keep him. You know, because he was scattered.
You needed him on the gun, really, didn't you, in the event of an air attack?
Yeah, also, too, he's nearly gone.
Yes.
So the only thing to do with him was to send him back.
He was your difficult man, wasn't he?
Yeah. But, I say, terrific, right throughout the rest of the time. But, you know, it's about anyone. When you get so much of that, and, you know, having been shot at quite a lot at different times, you know, you can't just shake it off. You've got to really fight to not let it get you.
Do you know what happened to him then?
Yes. He went back to base. Next thing I heard, he had joined the paratroopers and had been dropped at St. Armin. So he wasn't a coward. Mm. It just his nerve had gone for that particular
sort of thing.
I was from many of us that were very sort of shaky at that time.
When you'd been attacked like that and been very seriously frightened, how long did it take you to recover your composure?
Well, it depended. I mean, it affected some people more than others.
Of course.
But you were still very jumpy and you sort of looked at the things, but you tried to overcome it. Mm. You've got to say, well, the thing is, if you're there, you've got to accept the vulnerable. And if the men in your armoured car or troop see that you're frightened, I mean, just to think how they're going to feel. Actually, so you've got to sort of try to rise above it and fight it.
Now, you were saying earlier on that you can get used to being very tired and going without sleep. Could you get used to being frightened?
Or is it something different? You can get used to being shot at.
Yes.
But it didn't stop you from being a bit frightened, you know. Although I never felt any time I was going to be killed, you know, by the time I it's just that little bit of fear that you've got to overcome. Now, I overcame mine, I mean, a couple of weeks later, we'd been shot at and all that before. But on the last occasion, when I again, 18 Stukas came over.
Another occasion,
about a fortnight later. Mm. And by then, I was getting very jumpy. Mm. Very jumpy, you know, as all of us were, I think, because we'd been at it then for about a month, you know, sort of being shot in August. And we were going back near Masseuse, and we were having a conference in the back of a truck, the squadron, and suddenly someone shouted, "Stukas." And we were in the back of the seat at the conference, I think all troop leaders and NCOs, I think. And everyone jumped out of the truck. And there were stick changes that we had dug around this soft vehicle. And they had trenches they had to dive into. And I jumped out of the truck, and I felt the adherent stoop was coming over and starting to dive. And I felt to myself, if I jumped into the trench, it's all quickly sort of in my mind, if I jumped into that trench, that's me finished, I'm going to be there cowering, you see. And so I made a decision. There was about 50 yards away, I think, near enough. There was a whole big dug with sandbags around it, and we put in a bin gun as an attack position. And I made up my mind, that's where I'm going. And so I ran about 50 yards. I could hear the planes diving, you know, driving me on. I saw the parapet of this pit, and I jumped over it and got on the bin gun and fired. And then I'm out of the way. But I felt if I had dived into that trench, I think I would have been a nervous wreck from then on. And that's the only way I think you can. You've got to make an effort to hide your fear and overcome it, and then I think you're all right.
So it worked for you?
It worked for me. I didn't sort of have the same feeling from then on about when the planes came. You always try to shoot at them anyway, but if you could shoot back, then it made you forget any fear. You're doing something. It's when you're there waiting for the bomb to fall, that's when you feel vulnerable and frightened, I think. But if you're doing something, you've got something to, you know, especially if you've got another man with you who is frightened and you can get him, come on, do this and that sort of thing, you're doing something.
Did you have another man with you in the...
No.
But you managed to get the gun going.
Oh yes, that was all ready, you see. I knew it was there, ready, so I...
You engaged the Stukas.
Yeah, and that's the way to do it.
What damage did they do on that occasion, did they? Huh? What damage did they do on that occasion?
I don't think anybody in the regiment was killed or anything. You know, they used to come and you were spread out and you might get... the odd vehicle hit, but very rarely affected. You know, there's always somewhere in the shrapnel or whatever.
Yes.
But I don't think we had any casualties on that particular occasion. This was well after we'd gone from this place, I think, and we'd gone on to various places where we were being shot at, shelled off positions and whatnot, and then we were given a task where we got behind the enemy, I think, and just Matt and I, and we were going along near Surtee with the Gulf on our right, and it was completely isolated. There was nobody, I don't think, certainly none of the British forces had gone that far. We were pushing on.
You're way ahead.
Way ahead, you know, and there was Matt in the lead, and I was behind him. And there was white sort of sand and hill. It's a terrible area, it really was. And over on our right was a hill, or not much of a hill, but sand, a bank thing, which obviously you couldn't see the sea at all. It was all the other side of it. And this coast filled with salt, sort of marsh and things like that. And an ideal place for an ambush. And it was an awful area. And sort of threatening. And we were going along, sort of looking everywhere to see whether there was any sort of trap or gun or anything, because it was so easy to set a trap there. But I think we were so far behind the lines there.
You're too far behind the lines to find the enemy.
So we were going along quite nice, and we were hoping that as far as we could, that was our aim to get to Tripoli first, if we could. And of course, the further we could get, especially if nobody else had been there, it was a great thing, up to Surtee and then up to sort of the bottom of the Gulf, isn't it? You know, you came down from Benghazi and then you went up north to Tripoli. And we were quite pleased with our dreams. And as we were going along, I happened to look behind. Coming over the hill to our rear was a tank and a lorry with a gun on it, and one of these guns. That was quite open, it wasn't, it didn't have a...
The anti-tank gun on a portee.
Well, that was a bigger lorry, it was a bigger thing, it was the same sort of thing, but the gun was sort of available to turn any direction. Yeah. It came over the hill and was on its way down with the tank. And I looked down, God. And I got on the radio with him there, and I said, have you seen the addition to our troop? To our rear, he looked back at me and said, Christ! I said, well, he said, Christ, go south! And we turned off the road and headed south, you know, out into the desert. Because the gun, the tank and the gun couldn't fire at us, but it was on a slope.
Oh, I see.
So it couldn't get the...
They couldn't bear.
It couldn't bear onto us. Mm. Otherwise, we would have had it without any doubt at all.
Do you know, were these German or Italian, or do you know what they were?
I assume they were German. I didn't talk to my coach. I just saw it and said, what? And had I not looked and seen them, they'd have got on the flat behind us. That would have been it. We had nowhere to go.
Mm.
And so anyway, we turned south and we went into the desert as hard as we could go. And we kept going, and it was a beautiful moonlight night. This was about 4 o'clock, I think, in the afternoon, somewhere like that.
So you kept going through the dark on that occasion?
Yeah, well, we kept to the off dark, and then we sort of stopped for the night. Beautiful moonlight night. And that was even more frightening, really, because they didn't think they could come and they could see you.
So you were just two armoured cars all on your own?
So we stayed there the night. And the next morning, we made our way and found C Squadron, who I think they had lost about 3 armoured cars that day. They'd been a tank battle and whatnot. And they'd lost 3 armoured cars. And I went to see the squadron leader, and it was Arthur Gemmell, who was the squadron leader. And he looked very dejected, and, you know, very upset. And there was a number of tanks that had run out of petrol, the Crusader tanks. We'd lost quite a number of them in a bit of a battle that day. And apparently, we went off. Sea Squadron were there as well, and the rest of the regiment, and I think all the echelon were in this area. And suddenly, we were between 2 columns of enemy.
How far apart were the columns of enemy?
I'd say probably a couple of miles, and we were in the middle.
They were just moving to left and right of you?
That's right, and we were in the middle, and there we were going absolutely flat out. I don't know what direction we were going, but I know we were all going, the armoured cars on the outside, firing smoke, firing our guns, and they were firing in. And it was just like...
It sounds chaotic.
It was chaotic. And I saw Bob Morgan, he was a sergeant in the B squad, and I saw his armour car knocked out behind me. Obviously, I couldn't do anything, I couldn't go on.
Couldn't stop.
Nobody could stop. Mm. And we kept going. And my driver kept saying to me, they're running out of petrol. I didn't know whether they were going to run out of petrol. You know, because it was so low, and I thought, oh, God, that petrol now, that's it. But anyway, we kept going. And I think altogether we lost a lot of the echelon. And I think probably about 70 men that day, not killed, but, you know, lost.
Lost.
Yeah, and prisoners and whatnot. And so we kept going until we got out of it.
So you were able to outrun the tanks?
Yeah, outrun them, yeah.
What sort of tanks were they? Did you?
Well, I think they would probably be the Mark IIIs.
So they wouldn't be able to keep up with armoured cars.
Not necessarily, no. But like I say, the columns, they might have been sort of trucks as well. Also,
yes.
You know, those the 2 columns that were coming up by the side. And I don't know whether they realised what we were or what, but like I say, with the smoke and the shooting and whatnot, we kept going until it got dark, and then we met up. Managed to have enough of getting a petrol
Where did you get the petrol from?
Oh, the Echelon.
Oh, some of the Echelon had come out.
Didn't have everything.
When all these things were going on, were you able to keep in touch with the bigger picture?
We weren't, no. I mean, we were only concerned about our particular task.
Your own sector.
What the big picture was, we didn't really know. I think the commanding officer did, and those, but we weren't so interested in that particularly.
What about keeping in touch with home? Were you able to maintain touch?
Well, up to then, we left home in October, and up till then, it was now, I think, January sometime, we hadn't had a letter or any communication with home at all. The first thing I've got the date, which I'll tell you later on, which the first communication we had from the time we left home, I think, was about 4 months.
That's an awful long time to go without
yes.
news.
Yeah, and I had a brother I know who was with the Norfolk Regiment in Singapore. And I had no news of him, and I was concerned about him as well, you see.
Did you get newspapers at all while you were?
No. Nothing. The first thing we got was an airmail letter.
Aerogram.
Aerogram, that's right. Three lines on it. And all we used to send out was a card. I'm all right, and so on, so on, so on. And you crossed out with.
So field postcard.
That's right.
I mean, could you get radio broadcasts at all on your... You couldn't?
Well, we could. I think you could do, but I mean, you're more concerned about ourselves and... We didn't have the time for it, really, because we were involved the whole time.
You didn't have a chance to go back and get out of action at all?
No.
So there's no question of rotation?
No. We were in the 9 as a squadron, and that was it. The only time you went back is if your armour car was knocked out, and you were sent back. But, whereas I was, if my car was knocked out, I'd get another one and stay up there. And in fact, I was 6 solid months.
Didn't you find that something of a strain, being forward all the time?
I was doing something worthwhile, and that's my job, and I didn't get a thought. I was sending people back off leave, on leave, and where else I could have gone, but I thought, well, you know, if I go back and something happens, somebody's killed me, you know, I think myself, well, should I have gone back? You know, could I have done anything about it if I hadn't gone back? And it was just silly, really.
You'd have felt guilty about something.
I'd have felt guilty about it.
Even if you couldn't have helped.
That's right. But if the whole squadron went back, it'd be a different matter, you see.
Of course.
So, no, the last... I stayed right up to the Battle of Knightsbridge.
Yeah.
And after the Battle of Knightsbridge, we were going back, and I was with the C squadron then. And we were on our way back to Cairo for a refit. That was over 6 months. And these were on its way up, you see, and we were on the way back. I think Johnny could come out and something. And we stopped to talk to these squadron, and the squadron leader said to me, oh, put your kit on the car, and you're back with me now. And I said, gosh, I said, I've been up on the desert for 6 months. And I haven't seen a house, a tree, or a woman for 6 months. I said, and at a decent bath or anything. I said, can't we go back for 4 days? You know, just a break. He said, all right, you have 4 days leave, and then when that's up, you get a truck and you join me out in the desert somewhere. So I went back for 4 days, and I had to get a truck and buy it on my own from Cairo all the way up somewhere in the desert till I saw the squadron.
To find B squadron.
Find these one out in the desert, and I found them.
How did you keep clean when you were in the desert?
You didn't.
I mean, you just had to stay dirty.
You
had to
stay dirty.
Yeah.
You used to wash your clothes in petrol, and you didn't have enough water to drink, let alone wash and shave. In fact, I found at one stage I was blaming the radiator. My armoured car for a drop of water to get to each of my crew, and I wouldn't drink myself. And that went on, and then when the water did arrive, about 3 or 4 days later, a 2 gallon can for the 3 hours to last another week or so. I had to pour it straight into the radiator. And I found one armour car, along with Silky Sparks.